The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
Reflect on the hard conclusions you have arrived at by vicariously accepting what you read and watch, which is curated material. Whether it's the newsroom producer or a big tech algorithm, what you feel is a reflection of thinking done for you and a feeling by design. Right and left are both culpable.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, you know, one of the things that we value the most with this program is talking to people who may not always agree with us so that we can listen to other ideas. And I've watched the country here over the last, especially the last few days, and there's a fear. There's a fear of speaking what you believe because you may be censored or you may lose your job. And so, yeah, I was thinking about it. In an abusive relationship, oftentimes the abuse comes from one person basically inflicting their views on another and not allowing the other to have a voice. What do you think?
Yeah, it seems that there's a difference between those who seek truth and those who wish to establish power. I suppose they're not mutually exclusive, but it would in practical terms appear that way, where looking to establish power is at the expense of seeking truth. It's no longer the first priority. And so you do see a unique dynamic today socially.
Yeah, it really has been hitting me over the last week too. The true enemy, we have to know who the true enemy is. The left is not the enemy of the right, and the right should not be the enemy of the left per se. The enemy right now is those who are shutting the voice down. And you said something last night that I think is just, it's worth repeating. Valuing voice is an antidote to dehumanization. What we're seeing is the dehumanization of two sides, but it's because the voice is being shut down. And so I'd like to talk about that today, Dave, but I also, why don't we get the markets out of the way? Because there are some things going on in the markets that are worth talking about, but I want to get back to this voice that's been shut down.
Absolutely. As for the markets, there are 1,000 things to discuss, and they're important. But I think they do pale in comparison to the potential missteps afoot in the areas of social and political engagement.
Jim Deeds called me, and he talked about how Treasury yields had topped 1%. And he drew me to Bloomberg just to look at the commodities. And he said, Kevin, do you see what's happening? Interest rates are rising. People are moving out of cash, and they are moving into commodities. And he says, this is the sign of inflation. Now, what do you think, Dave?
Well, I think some of the highlights, the 10-year Treasury broke out to 1.17%. It's a 20% move in less than a week. That is very significant. You've had radical volatility, which has lifted stocks to all-time highs. Even as you've had insider selling spike, margin debt exploding to all-time highs, which is a leveraged speculation on the continued price move higher in the equities markets. And the investment world has begun to recalibrate to a new investment context. And I do think inflation is that theme, gaining momentum, which I think the net effect will be a major asset class recalibration and a rotation, which I think is already afoot.
You know, we've seen gold over this last week drop, but gold and silver, I mean, that is where you go, not just for deflation or not just for instability, but for inflation. So gold and silver, the relevance of gold and silver hasn't changed, has it?
They're as relevant as ever. And they reached support along major moving averages. Last week's price dynamics were suggestive of a deliberate hit. In other words, some price manipulation. And there was major impact trading, which is a colloquialism for manipulation. Major impact trading in both stocks and gold in support of a Biden and blue wave narrative, you know, that the blue wave is good for stocks.
Which, do you agree with that? I mean, the blue wave, good for stocks?
Not true, in our opinion. I mean, so here's the things that would be good for stocks. The free flow of capital, excessive monetary policy, excessive fiscal policy is going to get speculators' juices flowing. There's no doubt about that. But then there comes the sort of balancing act between getting what you want on the front end and ultimately paying a price for that in the end. I guess what you had this last week is the narrative creation and the perpetuation dynamics, which are very easy to game in the age of algorithms and model trading. So I think it's important to be careful. It doesn't reflect what's next, these activities in the stock market. What is next? I think for that, we have to watch the bond market. We have to watch the dollar and how those two markets trade over the next 6 to 12 months for a definitive view. And stocks are going to tell a very different story for quite a while. Stocks fall in line with the trends and messages sent from the fixed income and currency markets, but stock investors are always the last ones to get it. If you had a room full of really smart people, your stock traders are kind of the stupid ones in the mix compared to foreign currency and fixed income traders. I mean, as much as the impact trading was meant to move momentum and an upward trajectory for stocks last week, the most important dynamic was in the treasury market, highly consequential. And I think what we have to look for is the knock-on effects from an increasing cost of capital, which I think is going to be huge. You have those impacts within to the corporate realm and, of course, within every aspect of financing.
With as much chaos as we have, it's amazing to me that we still have such a strong risk-on attitude. You know, I've learned through the years talking to clients, I can hear their emotions, and people are worried about the politics. But, you know, when you've got Bitcoin hitting 40,000, you've got the stock market hitting all-time new highs during this kind of disruption, we haven't really seen the emotional shift yet, and I think we probably will. You know, 2008, we experienced an emotional shift where people, instead of worrying about how much money they're going to make on their money, they started worrying about their return of principal, you know, the old Will Rogers thing.
One of the more important articles that I looked at this last week was the Wall Street Journal. It's Sheila Bair and Lawrence Goodman. And I've met and talked with Lawrence before, and Sheila Bair, of course, was head of the FDIC during the last major financial crisis. They put together an opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal January 6th titled "Corporate Debt Relief is an Economic Dud." I think it's must reading. You have to consider the footprint of the Fed in this particular market environment and what the knock-on effects are, again, of the cost of capital. And when you begin to play with the cost of capital, you begin to influence investor behavior, speculator behavior. And to hear from the head of the FDIC and Lawrence Goodman, who's president of the Center for Financial Stability, a really key article to hone in on this week.
One of the things I love about this show, Dave, is the guests that we can have on, the people that we can reference. You know, I just referenced Jim Dietz, who's nearing 90 years old. You know, he's been a stockbroker since the 60s. When he calls, I listen, because it was like Howard Onstott up until about May of last year when Howard passed. He passed in 2019. But he was a mentor of mine. It's good to listen to the older men. The problem is most of these guys don't live to be 100, 110, 120. And so you've often turned me on to books of people who are no longer with us, but really feel like they should be a guest here on the weekly commentary, you know, like Jacques Roof. I still feel like I've had a conversation with Jacques Roof, you know, from the 1960s. And, you know, reading old speeches, you had mentioned to me last night that you've been reading old speeches. These are men who are no longer here, but we really probably would have enjoyed having as guests so that we can really hear their thoughts.
You know, when Martin Luther King Day rolls around, it's pretty common for me to read a speech for my kids. There's such drama and there is such power in those words and his ability to communicate. And, you know, for perspective, sometimes I will read old speeches, and particularly when there's crazy currents stirring at a cultural level and there seems to be just a feel of danger lurking everywhere. I find an insightful or impassioned or a subject-specific message, it brings some clarity to the current context, even if it's completely unrelated. And this weekend, I reread Malcolm X's speech, The Ballot or the Bullet, delivered in 1964 at a Christian church in Cleveland.
That wasn't necessarily to bring about peace, was it? I mean, he had a very, very pessimistic view of the basically avoidance of violence.
Well, what Malcolm X assumed is that no revolution had ever been bloodless, and that if ballot initiatives were blocked, then black nationalists would need to take up arms. 3 months later, you get violent riots breaking out in New York and a variety of other states, ironically, Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love.
Right, right.
And so I look at these speeches, and it's all for perspective.
Well, you turned me on to Vaclav Havel, who probably disproved Malcolm X's theory on that, because there was the Velvet Revolution that he was a key part of.
I invited Havel to be a guest on the commentary, and I didn't know at the time that he was dying of throat cancer. And so he kindly said he's not doing any public interviews anymore. And that's one of those sort of lifetime opportunities I feel was missed. But you're right, Vaclav Havel and the Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia, that was November 1989. So for the historical record, we can see that positive change can occur nonviolently. And I think if Malcolm X could, if he couldn't find a precedent for nonviolent revolution, it's because he either didn't look far enough back. You see sort of almost a first century revolutionary dynamic within Christianity and within the Roman state, or maybe he didn't maintain enough of an imagination to anticipate the crumbling of communism in Eastern Europe, because the Velvet Revolution certainly was nonviolent. In that case, you had one-party rule, which came to an end after 41 years. And, you know, stepping into power was Havel, a playwright, an artist. And he was central to the dialogue that caused a huge popular and nonviolent uprising. That's, again, the name Velvet suggests that. It was peaceful. It was thoughtful, even as it was impassioned. And Havel became the first democratically elected president in that post-communist period. So you could recall our conversation with Tomas Sedlicek. Tomas was Havel's chief economic advisor, and he was a polymath, still is. But at the age of 23, the polymath is advising a playwright.
He's one of my favorite guests that we've ever had on, you know, the economics of good and evil. You know, just before you go on, Vaclav Havel being a playwright, it's interesting when you bring an artist in who's a thinker. I've mentioned on the commentary over the last few weeks, I've just been studying parable, narrative and parable, and the truth that can only be conveyed through narrative or story. And it's interesting when you look at a Vaclav Havel, he wasn't just throwing issues out to make people mad. He literally was trying to bring forth a narrative of change, and it would be a narrative also of human dignity and rights.
Yeah, he was not an artist merely as an iconoclast, but also someone who cared about elevating, discovering, and seeing truth lived in a societal context. So it's challenging to think of today and how the current structures of information flow and intellectual bias would deal with the likes of a Tomas Sedlicek or a Vaclav Havel.
Do you think they would agree with what's going on right now with Facebook and Twitter and all these guys sort of directing at YouTube, Amazon, Apple, directing the narrative the way they would like to see it come out?
I would guess that the informational monopoly that exists today, and again, just sort of reflecting on the nature of power, it's a technocracy, not where you've got bureaucrats, highly trained and skilled, but literally Silicon Valley types. And I'm just not sure that social media outlets would have even allowed for their voices to be heard. The marriage of political power and corporate dominance expressed through informational monopoly, I think what it would have done is filter and eliminate the message, because what Havel brought to the fore challenged the status quo. And today you can see media and social media uniting to define what is allowable discourse. And so to me, maintaining a voice in the venues that are presently offered, it's becoming more and more a question of what is the dance? The dance requires a degree of compliance, of uniformity, that it's ironic to me that, you know, this summer when you've got cities ablaze and people are talking about starting a national conversation, that again, this compliance and uniformity, if you really wanted a national conversation, that uniformity and compliance makes a mockery of that suggestion.
It reminds me of Animal Farm. You know, there are some animals more equal than others, apparently. You know, all animals are equal, but there are some more equal than others. You know, I'm going to repeat that quote from last night because it's so powerful, because there is this dehumanization going on right now. Valuing voice is an antidote to dehumanization.
Well, I remember sitting with my eldest son outside the Harry S. Truman Presidential Library in Independence, Missouri, the first presidential library built, Congress enacted, I forget what the name of it was, 1955. But I was there a number of years ago, and just explaining that the road to the Oval Office was not always through the halls of established political power, at least not a straight line anyways. You know, prior to Truman's Senate win in 1934, he had been a very unsuccessful investor, in a variety of commodity investments, and then a business entrepreneur. And
I think he failed at that, didn't he?
And you might say, well, it wasn't so much his business acumen or lack thereof. He lost the haberdashery, a men's clothing store, fine clothing store, in the, quote, forgotten depression of 1921, as Jim Grant describes it. But circumstances were tough. And I think what we saw in the aftermath of sort of false start after false start was that this was a man who was not to be deterred.
Like Churchill, you know, he says, it's not how many times you get knocked over, it's how many times you get up.
And I mention him because of a famous quote that seems to rest solidly on my greatest frustration this week. He said, when even one American who's done nothing wrong is forced by fear to shut his mind and close his mouth, then all Americans are in peril. There's no doubt missteps, both political and social, inappropriate behaviors that were taken this last week in Washington, D.C. And I don't know that we have all the facts as of yet, but it would appear to me that there is that sense in which it's time to close the mind and close the mouth. And there is a sense in which peril, I feel it. We're not on the eve of national reconciliation or peace, nowhere close to it.
Right.
We are in a more dangerous place as of this weekend than we were the middle of last week.
Do you remember the book that you turned me on to, Exit, Voice, and Loyalty? When the voice is shut down, there's horrible, horrible ramifications.
Yeah. And for those of you who don't know Albert Hirschman, whether it's The Passions and the Interest or Exit, Voice, and Loyalty, I would read anything that he's written. It's not easy reading, but it's very insightful. And I think the silencing of opposition, whether it's through shaming or intimidation or doxing, it rejects the lessons of Albert Hirschman's first and foremost in the title, Voice, because voice is a means of managing problems and pressures as they emerge within a system. So his classic work, you've got to read it, Exit, Voice, and Loyalty. It highlights how organizations, any kind of organization, whether it's a company or a family or a country, can influence outcomes with an understanding of social dynamics that carry people through maintaining or rejecting loyalty. And again, this can be brand loyalty, it can be family loyalty, it can be political affiliation. It applies to virtually any organization. But exiting an existing construct altogether, or as he powerfully argues, finding a degree of satisfaction in contentment in having a voice, even if the social construct is not going to comply or transform or be precisely what is desired, voices like that release valve on a pressure cooker.
You know, we have the train here in Durango we often use as an example, and it's a steam engine. And when that steam builds up to a point where it has to be released, you can hear it. You know, they release that steam, and it is really an excellent metaphor, I guess, of what you're talking about. I can tell you right now, Dave, there are a lot of people out there that I don't agree with. But I would never want to still their voice purposely and mute them purposely to where they can't express what they believe.
Yeah, I think the greatest risk of deteriorating social cohesion and escalation of tensions since last week's Electoral College confirmation, it comes from the imposition of silence.
Yeah.
You go
yeah.
back to Hirschman's commentary on voice, and that's what's critical. Without it, I fear we are at the Rubicon.
Mm.
So, you know, allowing for dialogue and debate and the expression of different opinions, that's been out of favor in academic circles for more than a generation. And that's ironic, right? Allowing for dialogue and debate, the expression of different opinions in both the media and social media seems to be going the way of the ivory tower.
It seems like we have more suppression the more we are able to communicate with each other.
A couple of things that I've been enjoying reading and are just helpful in terms of sort of processing the context that we have put ourselves into, not this week, this month, this year, but over the last decade or more. Cynical Theories is a book worth reading. Cynical Theories. And while you're ordering it, please order from your local bookstore. Get a copy of Kasim Kassam's Vices of the Mind and Tim Grossclose's Turn Left. Both of these came from Justin McBrayer's bibliography.
Mm.
You might recall our conversation on fake news with Justin in November.
Boy, was that timed well, huh?
Appropriately timed, yeah. I think. Trump's comments have never been timely. Trump's comments have never been genteel. They've never been decorous. And clearly, neither the context nor the rhetoric he used last week was well thought out. So after 4 years, you would think we would know what to expect.
Yeah, but don't you think we should be allowed to make that decision ourselves instead of just putting a mute on it?
I think when we see sort of the left-leaning political apoplexy and the media's treatment of last week's events in contrast to 9 months of social chaos, rioting, violence, burning, and looting in the name of Black Lives Matter, we have a testament to the Pravda-esque nature of traditional and social media.
Mm-hmm.
What is acceptable violence and what is unacceptable violence has been defined by television commentators with degrees in radio, television, and film, and not by philosophers and ethicists debating definition and meaning and agency and assumptions and ultimate consequence. The way we're engaged in today's tough issues is dangerous, if only because the skills needed, dare I say the character needed, to understand and to listen and to engage and problem solve, it's lacking. If you go back in time, you have Roger Ailes, former president of Fox News, who said decades ago, while he was working inside the Nixon administration, today television news is watched more often than people read newspapers,
mm-hmm.
than people listen to radio, than people read or gather any form of communication. The reason? People are lazy. With television, you sit, watch, listen. The thinking is done for you.
Yeah, and if you think any differently, again, going back to your quote, valuing voice is an antidote to dehumanization. If you think any differently, you're just not allowed to speak.
I'm also reminded of Edward R. Murrow. He's one of the greatest in broadcasting. Mm. I don't mean to completely disparage the trade, but I do think if you're going to define violence and what is acceptable violence as they did this summer, and what is unacceptable violence as they have done in the last, you know, 4, 5, 6 days, And I would be willing to say all violence is unacceptable. But what I'm not willing to concede is that news anchors are the new philosophers and ethicists of our day. I don't think they're qualified. Edward R. Murrow, again, one of the great broadcasters, he said, a nation of sheep will beget a government of wolves. And that's what I see. When I hear Roger Ailes from Fox News say that people are lazy, with television, you sit, watch, listen, and the thinking is done for you. What I hear is a generation of sheep being birthed, and from that we beget a government of wolves. And this is not just the Roger Ailes and the Fox News syndrome. We have Trump derangement syndrome on the other side with MSNBC and CNN and others. It's equal opportunity laziness, and it is a nation, not one side of the aisle, but a nation of sheep, which is begetting a government of wolves. Just process that. Ailes' comment, people are lazy, the thinking's done for you. Reflect on the hard conclusions you have arrived at by vicariously accepting what you read and watch, which is curated material. Whether it's the newsroom producer or a big tech algorithm, what you feel is a reflection of thinking done for you and a feeling by design. Right and left are both culpable. Again, we discussed the difficulty of engaging in current events with Dr. McBrayer. Order his book, Fake News. It's great. But also look at Kassam's critique, again, from his bibliography. Look at Kassam's critique of how we feed the vices of the mind. Review Gross Close, because what he does, you have to appreciate what academic research reveals about today's existing media bias. This is not conjecture. It's rigorous, testable academic research. What you eat and sleep and breathe and drink from the news is a distortion of reality, unintentionally and intentionally distorted. Read the book. It's valuable.
Well, and that's one of the reasons I'm really feeling like I need to return to understanding parable, which encases truth no matter what the news is saying. In other words, the truth is the truth at all times. And that's why, Dave, when you go back and read those speeches, okay, Malcolm X, Truman, Solzhenitsyn, when you go back and read these speeches, Martin Luther King, you can go back and say, okay, what's testable truth in what they had to say? In a way, it's the narrative again. And the difference between that and what we're being told to think right now, a lot of it's not true.
Yeah, whether it's Malcolm X or Alexander Solzhenitsyn, those classic speeches they're worth studying for their cultural insight, for their rhetorical flair, for the light that they shine even on current events. And you might look this up later, but Solzhenitsyn's Harvard commencement address titled A World Split Apart. You know, we're talking about social cohesion, and this is certainly more on a grand scale where he's looking at the world, not just a nation. But there's so much to learn. Again, perspective brought from Solzhenitsyn's Harvard commencement address, A World Split Apart. I put it in the category of must read. Just a couple of highlights that I thought would be worth sharing. He says, hastiness and superficiality are the psychic disease of the 20th century, and more than anywhere else, this disease is reflected in the press. Such as it is, however, the press has become the major power within the Western countries, more powerful than the legislative power, the executive, and the judiciary. And one would then like to ask, by what law has it been elected, and to whom is it responsible? In the communist East, a journalist is frankly appointed as a state official. But who has granted Western journalists their power? For how long a time, and with what prerogatives?
Yeah, you know, public affairs officers. It's sort of a way of controlling the people. Pravda, there were three Pravdas. I don't know if that's still the case, but there was a red one, there was a white one, and there was a green one. And it just depended on how inside you were to the party as to which paper you got to read.
Well, appropriately spoken to the graduating class at Harvard, he says, without any censorship in the West, fashionable trends of thought and ideas are carefully separated from those that are not fashionable. Nothing is forbidden, but what is not fashionable will hardly ever find its way into periodicals or books or be heard in colleges. Legally, your researchers are free, but they're conditioned by the fashion of the day. There is no open violence such as in the East. However, a selection dictated by fashion and the need to match mass standards frequently prevent independent-minded people giving their contribution to public life. And how he concludes, I think, is very appropriate. If the world has not come to its end, and I would agree with him, I don't think it has. But if the world has not come to its end, it has approached a major turn in history, equal in importance to the turn from the Middle Ages to the Renaissance. It will exact from us a spiritual upsurge. We will have to rise to a new height of vision, to a new level of life where our physical nature will not be cursed as in the Middle Ages, but even more importantly, our spiritual being will not be trampled upon as in the modern era. This ascension will be similar to climbing onto the next anthropologic stage. No one on earth has any other way left but upward.
Wouldn't he be a great guest? I mean, wouldn't you have loved to have had Solzhenitsyn on the show?
I think he died the year that we started the commentary, which those kinds of coincidences, they sadden me because I would have loved to have a conversation with him. There are people that we will know only inward, only from their speeches, but I would have enjoyed knowing personally. So why am I inspired and instructed by a diverse mix of dead men?
Right, right.
One's white, one's black, one's Muslim, one's Christian, one is from Russia, and one is from Omaha, Nebraska. You get tensions rise, and in the moment, everyone can feel when tensions are rising. It's like conflict in a marriage. You can feel that you are at a breaking point. The evidence seems clear that you are, and yet, if you did one thing, if you introduced time into the equation, you would see that, as they say, this too shall pass. Right? Because every moment of crisis is more intense in the experience than it is in the afterthought and the reflection. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
We often make mistakes when we're making choices from an impassioned place. And I think the intensity of the moment and what we're feeling culturally last week to this, the intensity of the moment and the clarity of thinking at that time actually turns out to be delusional, swayed by emotion, or again, as Kassam would describe them, the intellectual or epistemic vices. We need perspective. We need perspective. That's the whole point of this 14-year-old, in March, it'll be 14 years, commentary project.
Do you think, though, that the people out there even know, the people who are so angry right now, do you think they believe the other side is human? Do you think they really want to see a solution, or are they just mad?
Well, and I think that's where, again, if you stirred and asked where my fears are, it's not in current events. You know, I mean, when you see conflict, we see this every day in our house. We've got kids. Kids don't always get along. And you can, with parental perspective, say that today's relational crisis is really not a defining aspect of family life. And it's not going to be the ultimate, it doesn't give us ultimate bearing on where we're going from here.
Is it always the issue, or is it at times there's ad hominem attacks even within a family?
I think we are no longer at risk of genuinely misunderstanding each other. I think we are rather with prejudiced eyes and with prejudiced ears, no longer caring to even listen.
That's a scary place to be.
And yeah. So this goes back to the issue that we started with, the establishment of power versus the seeking of truth. And they're not mutually exclusive, but one can be at risk when the other's in play. And the establishment of power, domination, is something that I think is making the truth something very secondary.
Do you think the media is actually trying to move us toward violence versus peace? I mean, is their goal a peaceful resolution?
I think there is a peaceful resolution, but I think media in all its shapes and forms, social and otherwise, right and left, are conducting us towards violence and not away from it. And that scares me. It appalls me. What inspires me is, again, reflecting, gaining perspective in asking, is there, and I know the answer, but is there a better way forward?
Well, culture alone, okay, is held together by the rule of law. Now, that's another discussion for another day. But also, culture is considering the other person who may not agree with you human.
Yeah, the ad hominem attack, that's the first step to rhetorical dehumanization. And then after that dehumanization comes the real tragedy. Because once dehumanized, right and left are capable of any form of atrocity. Valuing voice is an antidote to dehumanization. Valuing voice reaffirms the dignity of each individual, regardless of whether you agree with them. Then comes the hard work of sorting out the contribution of a particular voice. Now, we can talk about fake news versus factual news, reasonable opinion versus absurd opinion, falsity versus truth. I don't want to limit voice. But there is a sorting process, a weighing process in the search for truth. And this is where not all opinions and voices equally correspond to reality.
Dave, I remember in 1982, I was 19 years old and engaged to be married. It was an interesting time in my life, very exciting time in my life. But there was this huge monopoly for communications called Bell, and it was broken up by the government for the sake of the American public. Now we've got Facebook, we've got Amazon, we've got Apple, we've got Twitter, we've got these platforms where people are communicating, but these platforms are using monopoly at this point to bring forth their own and their only, you know, their very narrow narrative. I just wonder if we are not careful. We need to understand the enemy isn't each other, okay? The left, the right, what have you. Our enemy right now is monopoly.
Well, I mean, life is complex, and the markets are complex, and a worldview, although it's nice to organize things neatly according to sort of prepackaged categories, almost like you're going to through a college syllabus, there's a lot of messiness and a lot of detail and a lot of nuance that needs to be appreciated. You know that I'm a free market oriented guy, but I also think that there are complications that come with a 100% free market approach.
You and I have discussed that. Yeah, you've got to find a way to fight monopoly because it's a natural clumping event in a free market economy.
Yeah, it is self-interest on display, and we recognize the power of self-interest. For the good as well as for evil. And I think this is where if you appreciate an ethical or moral spectrum, you can see that anything that can be used for good can also be used for evil. And I think there seems to be confusion around, you know, this last week, people being cut off from social media platforms.
Mm-hmm.
It should be clear that a private run enterprise has the right to operate as it sees fit. That is entirely appropriate. And individuals, in turn, have the right to engage that private enterprise for services or goods or not. That's a market dynamic. I think it's also a reminder that free enterprise without guidelines and rules tends towards monopoly.
Right.
So many people love free enterprise so much that they don't see the end from the beginning and would even set aside the need for any regulation. And that was the whole discussion around this not 230 rule, but what is it, regulation 230? I notice that all of this has happened since Georgia. And there will be no implication, it would appear. There's big tech operating with seeming impunity in a world where legislators are not going to go after them. And that risk existed until the middle of last week.
And you said, you know, monopoly. Monopoly brings and comes with power.
In this case, it rivals political power. And that's what was suggested by Alexander Schultz and Eason's comments about media as well. It's an unelected power And in this case, you know, today we see it being addressed in Europe, particularly with your big tech companies being scrutinized by Europe.
Well, you were wondering about this years ago. Nazlee Chokri, you know, when we had her on, it was like, who controls the internet when things go awry?
Yeah, this is not me poking anybody in the eye, but we discussed the control of the internet by private or government entities and even looked at sort of what it means to have this issue of transnational power, transnational communication, transnational influence. Who controls the internet? Mm-hmm. Who controls it?
Yeah.
Is it a commercial question tied to an investment theme? Maybe, but that's not the most important thing as far as I'm concerned. You've got a question of informational freedom. You've got a question of individual autonomy. You've got a question tied to, frankly, one of the core values of this podcast. Can we maintain a free exchange of ideas in pursuit of the truth? We assume that the pursuit of truth is additive, that it's cumulative, that it's an evolutionary process that requires ongoing engagement, reflection, and analysis.
And it shouldn't be dangerous.
No, and it has to include dialogue with a variety of perspectives. That's what's necessary to the discovery and elevation of truth. We don't claim to be the fountain or source of it. It's like looking through a spyglass. If you've got a pair of binoculars, you're looking for it in all of its forms, in every landscape, constantly.
Remember when Pilate looked at Jesus and he said, "What is truth?" Not knowing what he was actually looking at. Truth is important, but humans, humanization, going back to what you said, if you mute the voice, okay, if you mute the voice, you dehumanize the person. I'm just changing your quote, but that's the truth.
Yeah, and I think valuing and dignifying another person, that includes investing time and attention in their point of view. It's not an immediate write-off. Valuing and dignifying another person, regardless of agreement or disagreement, it's like the modified golden rule. Do to others what you wish them to do to you. So you're extending kindness. There's a generosity of spirit in terms of giving someone the benefit of the doubt as you listen and attempt to learn. There's patience, there's attention, there's consideration, there's an accounting for personal prejudice and assumptions which might preclude your own ability to actively listen and to appreciate the value of a view that someone else holds to be critical.
Not to mute them.
And note that the media trend is more reflective of the academic trend of the last 20 plus years.
To silence.
Shame, insult, humiliate, discredit, begin with a personal or character assassination, and it's usually not necessary from that point forward to engage a topic or an issue with intellectual rigor. Why would you need to if you're talking about the establishment of power versus the search for truth? And it's just ironic that that is the most common classroom tactic in the ivory tower. Again, shame, insult, humiliate, discredit, the character assassination. Well, you're just one of these or those. But when these things occur, guess what happens? If you start to strip the voice of any dignity, social tensions increase. Mm-hmm. Silencing is not a solution for social ills or disagreements. Go back to Hirschman's exit voice and loyalty. Dysfunction, if you want to think of it in relational terms, you know, when suppressing this sort of something that's not healthy in a relationship, you can suppress it and suppress it and suppress it. And it comes out in other ways, not always predictably. Over the weekend, I had this conversation with a friend of mine, and she said, "What you're describing is a woman too large to fit in a corset. It's just going to pop out somewhere else." I thought, oh, okay, so you don't want to be a stuffer was the moral of the story. Let voice be a part of a healthy relational dynamic.
Dave, that's why I value the listeners. You know, we talked on the question and answer programs over the last couple of weeks how much we value the insights of the listeners and the things that they had to actually had to say through their questions. So I would just encourage our listeners to keep listening. We would like to also encourage a free speech and free market of speech. There'll be no muting.
We appreciate that you can say things that are inappropriate and you can say things that are reckless. And we've certainly gotten used to that over the last 4 years. If I were to contrast Reagan's rhetorical skill with that of Sir Donald, it's just, there's no comparison. There's no comparison. But I think the idea that somehow we allow for a voice to fade or to be silenced, we lose so much in a democracy if we lose the ability to speak our minds, to engage in dialogue, and to continue to learn, because there is so much that we just don't know.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, and you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.